Hi there, Dr. B here with your Module 7 clarifying lecture. This is the last lecture of the term. I typically don't do a Module 8 clarifying lecture because most people have moved on, usually to the next course. So this is usually the last one that I do. For most of you, you may have either started the final exam or you're in the process of it. Remember that Julie Schenk will be emailing your GMU address with your final exam feedback form. That will go under assessments. You'll just upload that. It really doesn't affect your final grade, but it's feedback for the program. So it's not automated. You're not going to get it right after you take the exam. So be patient if you don't get it right away. Your final paper is going to be turned into Blackboard. So what you're going to do is that you're going to take that Google Doc. You're going to remove all the markup. You're going to remove all of the comments that have been made. You're going to change everything to black ink. You're going to make sure that your fonts are all consistent. Keep the headings, and then put your bibliography at the end of your paper. Transfer that to a Word document or PDF. Either one works. And upload that to Blackboard. You will be checked on SafeAssign for plagiarism. If you find your own plagiarism, because you'll be able to view your own reports, you can fix it and turn it in without penalty. So I know I turned in a paper once and it was somewhat embarrassing because I found a paragraph that was written by this obscure Swedish guy. And I emailed the professor and I'm like, oh my gosh, can I fix this? And the professor was kind enough to let me fix it. So I'm going to extend that same courtesy to you, of course. But make sure that you're turning that in. All right, let's talk a little bit about your inner teaching. I'm just going to answer the questions this week really quickly. There were no questions on the form, so I'm just going to go through all of the questions on the inner teaching itself. So there was a line from an old musical that says, "Careful of what you say, children will listen." How many of you were in Into the Woods in high school? How might that be interpreted from a rule-governed perspective? So children listen to what we say, although sometimes it feels like they don't, and they determine rules from that. So you may have, you know, been looking in the mirror and trying on something and said, "I'm so fat." And then you're, you know, hearing your children play and they're, you know, they're playing dress up and look in the mirror going, "Oh, I'm so fat." That would be an example of a rule that they've learned. And those are insensitive to environmental contingencies, so they're really hard to change once they get into the repertoire. Or something like, "I have to get an A to be smart." That would be a rule that a child might learn. Or, "I'm really good at sports," might be a rule that they've learned. And there may be a sport that maybe they don't acquire as quickly, but that rule, "I'm really good at sports," still sticks. All right. How might you put together a program that addresses categories? A lot of people had trouble with this, so I want to spend some time with it. I'm not looking for an actual lesson plan, and I think I worded this a little bit trickily, so I probably should change it. What I'm really looking at is equivalence categories. So let's say we're setting up categories of vehicles. So let's say A is trains, B is cars, C is airplanes, right? So let's look at A equals A. So we're going to select exemplars from each of these categories. We're going to teach them, okay? Now we're going to look at the A equals B relationship. So we may have the child sort trains and cars and have them discriminate trains, cars, and maybe something like fruits and veggies, Okay, so there's some sort of distractor category. Now, let's teach the B equals C relationship. Airplanes, cars, and that distractor category to mastery. Now I'm going to do a test and see if the student generalizes when I put trains and airplanes together with that fruits and veggies category. That's where that equivalence comes in, that transitivity. Okay, so if I teach A equals B and B equals C, will the student be able to generalize that A equals C without extra training? Okay, so that's where I was going with that. All right, the next one, sometimes people get a little cognitive or mentalistic with this one. The answer is really actually quite simple, as is the one with Susie as well. It's been shown that using alternative and augmentative communication systems, such as picture exchange communication system, remember that PECS is a curriculum and a system. There's no such thing as a PEC. Take my pet peeve for a walk there. I will take off points when people say, give a PEC. There's no such thing. It's picture communication card. Actually increases the use of spoken speech. So why would that be the case using equivalence? So if you hand a picture over and that represents the item, so I give you a picture, you give me an item, that's an A equals B relationship, right? The other thing that you do in PECS is that when you're handing over the item, you're saying, oh, I want an apple. So now you're teaching the B equals C relationship. And notice I'm saying, I want an apple, so that you don't have to reverse the, you want an apple, I want an apple. It's always from the student's perspective. So now if I'm pairing the picture with the item, and I'm also pairing the item with the word, then sometimes that vocalization is going to emerge without training because I've taught an equivalence category, an equivalence set. That's why you see vocalizations often emerge without training. So it's an equivalence type of paradigm. Okay, so let's talk about Susie. This one, people, you know, they want to talk about self-esteem. They want to talk about all kinds of cognitive stuff. Let's boil it down. Other kids called her Stupid Susie. She got help for her LD in high school, but she still didn't interact much with others. She would often make excuses that she had to study. She'd study for several hours per night, say, I'm gonna fail. But the funny thing was is that Susie had straight A's. So what is the definition of rule governance? Rule governance says that a rule specifies the contingencies, and those contingencies persist in the face of changing actual environmental contingencies. So in the actual environment, Susie could probably study for 20 minutes a night and still get A's. Yet the rule is I'm stupid and I'm going to fail. Therefore, I must study for several hours a night. That's why that's rule governance. Okay, it's insensitive to the current contingencies. And once it's there, it's extremely hard to break. And Steve Hayes, and if you've read A Liberated Mind, if you haven't, it's a great read. He talks about how you can break some of that rule governance using acceptance and commitment therapy or training. It's a little bit outside the scope of 619 and actually the six core sequence. I think Dr. Hoke gets into it a little bit in verbal behavior, but it will be, you know, once you get certified, very much something that you might want to look into as continuing education. All right, let's talk a little bit about Skinner and Johnston, especially in terms of counter control. So you're going to read in 623 Murray Sidman's Coercion and its Fallout. And if you replace this idea of control with the term coercion, using punishment, threats, and such, and negative reinforcement as a way of kind of keeping societal behavior under control, then you kind of have the idea of what Skinner's talking about. And what he's saying is that if you're saying that do this and you'll avoid that, that's negative reinforcement, right? If you do this, you'll avoid that. That tends to promote rebellion or the bare minimum or, you know, all those side effects that we've talked about at length throughout this course. So, you know, and Skinner says that things like compassion, feelings, morals, things like that really have their roots more in the contingencies and the rules rather than these ideas of feeling good, altruism, things like that. Those are explanatory fictions. And he says, really, it's more the contingencies of reinforcement. And sometimes those contingencies of reinforcement aren't necessarily what society would call quote unquote good. Because you got to remember that in behaviorism, there is no good or bad. Good or bad is actually part of all these contingencies. Those are words that we've created within these contingencies. They're not actual things. So what's good and bad is very relative in Skinner's paradigm, which is really hard for some people. And I'm going to get into that in just a second. But if you use positive reinforcement, you're not going to evoke those rebellious behaviors. So if you look at it from Skinner's point of view, and if you look at it actually from Sidman's point of view, a world in which positive reinforcement is used, adding things to the environment to increase behavior, not happy positive reinforcement, but additive, is going to create a society that is more harmonious than one that is controlled by threats of punishment and negative reinforcement, or do this to avoid that. And that our culture is shaped by our environment, and our environment is just sets of contingencies. Luckily, in chapter 13, Skinner finally addresses these private events that we've been talking about all this time and why we don't talk about them all that much. And it takes him several pages to say this. But what he's saying is that most behavior can be explained by external forces. So the internal stuff isn't really as necessary. Now, remember that this was written in the early 70s. So some things have evolved in the last 45 years. Let's see, I'm almost 47. So, you know, he wrote this around the time I was born. So if that gives you an idea. There were a lot of things when this was written that we couldn't predict, manipulate, or control scientifically under the skin. Science has come a long way, but it hasn't come 100% of the way. So there's a lot of things within the brain we can't answer. We know a lot more about the brain than we did in Skinner's time, but there's still a heck of a lot more we don't know. And one of them is that there's no way to know, is my experience the same as yours? There's absolutely no way to know. If I say I'm in pain, is my pain feel the same way as your pain? No way to know. So what Skinner says is that if we stick to the most simplest answer, we're going to stick to the outer world as much as possible. And then when the outer world contingencies fail us, that's when we're going to maybe look within. So, you know, and then the other thing is, you know, do we accurately observe our own behavior? Well, the question is, how would you know? I mean, maybe, maybe not, because the only person who can observe your own behavior inside the skin is you. And am I accurate? I can't predict that. Maybe I am. I think I am. I don't know. Nobody can confirm that. And that's what Skinner's trying to say about the world inside. So now let's get into Johnston. So we're going to end this clarifying lecture on kind of a very deep philosophical note. So, you know, we're talking about ethics and or society and culture as sets of contingencies, right? So does that mean that there's no such thing as ethics? Does that mean there's no such thing as values? Does that mean that there's, you know, no such thing as right and wrong? Johnston would say no. What it means is that it's relative to the environments that we live in. So what is right and what is wrong is determined by our environment. Okay, determinism, determined by our environment, determined by the rules, determined by the reinforcers, determined by the punishers, all those types of things. What are rights then? Rights are, can somebody else control my access to reinforcers and punishers? So not to get political, but if you watched some of the Democratic debate, one of the questions that was asked was, in New York, they have a tax on sugary items. So does somebody have a right? Can they control my access to sugary items, assuming that those sugary items are a reinforcer? Okay, I'm not going to give you an answer to that question because everybody's going to have their own answer to that question. Okay, determined, right? And that's what makes the world go round. That's the cool part. If we look at all these different things that go on, you know, when you look at the court system, is really about, you know, who gets to control access to reinforcers and punishers. And if you really look at it that way, it gets really fascinating. Now, values, Johnston says that they're a description of our reinforcers. I disagree with Johnston here. I like Steve Hayes's explanation that they're actually a description of the rules that we live under, that they're actually a description of our rule-governed behavior. And so while Johnston says we're describing our reinforcers, I don't think we can do that very well. I think that we are better equipped to describe our rule-governed behaviors because they are part of verbal behavior. And I buy into Steve Hayes's explanation way more than I buy into Johnston's. Does that mean I'm right? Who knows? But that is where I stand with that. I probably should have said this a long time ago, but I wanted to end on this note because I think it's really, really, really important for you to get this part. That we've talked a lot about determinism. We've talked about Skinner seeing the world as very relative with regard to reinforcers and punishers and how the world works and things like that. And sometimes some people can look at this as GMU or Dr. B or whoever is trying to indoctrinate people. And for sure, there are professors who are trying to indoctrinate people into this way of thinking. But I want you to know that when it comes to ABA, that part of this is that if everything is determined, if I believe everything is determined, then your beliefs are your beliefs. And so I am never going to say you need to believe a certain way, or you have to be, you know, you can't believe in free will, or you can't have religion, or you can't have this, or you can't have that. What I'm asking you to do, and what all of the professors in this program will ask you to do, is be able to cogently explain Skinner's position. what you take from it and what your position is always going to be your position, and that's fine. I think that's good. I think that's a good thing. But you have to be able to explain Skinner's position in order to explain yours. So I just wanted to end on that note because I think it's really important because we're going through a lot of philosophy here, and it can be hard, especially if this totally turned your position upside down, to end on that. All right, so this is it. This is the last clarifying lecture of the term. I will be in touch before final grades are turned in. And on behalf of myself and Michael and Elizabeth and Rhea, I just wanted to say thank you for all of your hard work this semester. It really was a pleasure teaching you, and I look forward to seeing you all in future classes.